This podcast focuses on the impact of the Russian buildup of forces on the border of Ukraine and Belarus, specifically assessing the likely diplomatic response from NATO and our allies. We look at the potential triggers that might cause this to transition to military action, what that would mean for the U.S. focus on the Indo-Pacific region, and how industry can align itself to support the U.S. efforts both leading up to conflict and what actions would be necessary should conflict arise. Jim McCarthy, SES, U.S. Navy retired, former Assistant Deputy CNO, Integration of Capabilities and Resources, and current VP of Naval Programs at Cyprus International, acts as moderator of the discussion. Guest speakers include Admiral Scott Swift, U.S. Navy retired, former Commander, U.S. Pacific Fleet, and Admiral Jamie Fogo, former Commander, U.S. Naval Forces Europe, and former Commander, U.S. 6th Fleet. The podcast addresses the causes leading to the current situation in Belarus and Ukraine, the likely objectives and motivations for Russia's stance in the region, the diplomatic efforts associated with controlling this region, and where and how this might turn into open conflict between Russia and NATO, including the impact such a conflict would have on U.S.-China tensions in the South China Sea.
Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today for this discussion about what's going on in world events, both in Indo-Pacific and in Ukraine. I think the first question I'd like to start with is one about the U.S. desire frequently to try to come up with a bipolar world a la the Cold War, where we could focus all of our capabilities and requirements in a single theater. And every time we've tried to do that in the last 20 years, it appears that the things that we relegate to second order problems end up being first order problems and prevent us from shifting to that bipolar world. So as we look at trying to shift to an Indo-PACOM focus and at the same time deal with things European, I'd like to take a little bit of time to discuss what that means for the Indo-PACOM theater. And then, you know, how do we deal with the challenges that are, you know, coming out of the European theater? So to start with, Admiral Swift, could you sort of give us your thoughts based on your background in Indo-PACOM?
Yeah, thanks for that, Jim. And as an opening, if I could just take a minute and thank you and Cyprus for hosting these podcasts. This is the second one we've done panels before. And just in the preparation for the podcast, it's extremely valuable for me to do the research and then the back and forth that Jamie has had. And the fact that you've got me, who the vast majority of my experience is in the Indo-Pacific and Middle East, and you've got Jamie with an incredible amount of experience in the Middle East and Europe, I think this is a great opportunity for me to get a deeper understanding, and I hope the audience as well. Let me answer the question this way. First of all, let me focus on that question specifically contained just within the Indo-Pacific. So I was just in a track two discussion yesterday with some Chinese counterparts, and this question was raised. If there is a conflict, what will the trigger be and where will it occur within the Indo-Pacific? I wrote an article recently in the ChinaFile.com. There are five of us that wrote on it. And the subject of the article is, will China invade Taiwan? And uncoordinated responses from the five writers. We all wrote independent of any discussions with each other. And my response is summarized as, it depends. And there were several others that took that same approach. So this idea that somehow we can isolate our national security strategy to one issue or one region, we have proven this wrong time and time again. We have to look more broadly just within the Indo-Asia Pacific. I don't know where a trigger is going to be in the South China Sea or the East China Sea or on the peninsula. You know, we've diminished exercises on the pen, and I know there's a rich discussion about risk associated with that. I am focused on, I think China is a primary concern, but we are putting ourselves at risk from a national security perspective if we think we can focus just on that, especially when you have a consequential competitor like Russia. If you look at a country who was willing to take actions, and I think I'll defer to Jamie on this, I think there's a much greater necessity in the minds of the Russians, Putin in particular, to act. My biased view is it's because of their economic weakness compared to the economic strength of China. Now, China's not biding its time. They're moving out in an assertive kind of way. But as I see them take actions and consider actions, it's very thoughtful. I don't see that so much on the case of the Russians. Here's one last point that I'll make. There are opportunists out there, the big five. You know, we talked in the past, we talked about China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and then non-state actors. I think those fives are primary in my wheelhouse all the time. Because if there is a major conflict, it doesn't matter where it's triggered. If it's triggered with Russia or China or Iran or elsewhere, non-state actors are going to take advantage of that instability to act. And we've seen it with respect to activities in the Middle East where an area heats up and then we see another action taken. So I think we have to be much more thoughtful and much broader in our thinking. I hope that is reflected in Secretary Austin's integrated deterrence approach, this recognition that we need to engage more with allies, partners, and friends, not just in the Indo-Asia Pacific, but elsewhere. But let me pause and offer you an opportunity to comment on that, Jim, and then turn to Jamie.
No, thanks. I think that's pretty clear. And certainly, you know, PACOM, and to your point, more broadly, the entire world is going to be the threats that we're going to have to deal with. I'd like to turn this over to Admiral Fogo and get your thoughts on this starting question.
Hey, thanks, Jim, and Natso, and to echo Natso's remarks, thanks for putting this podcast together on a very timely subject. When we talked about this, you know, a month ago, it was not as hot as it is right now in the Black Sea. And so I think you picked a particularly good time to address our listeners and some of our clients on the way forward. Well, first of all, I would agree with Natso. There can't be just one pacing threat. I mean, we live in a multipolar world. This is not, you know, in the days of the United States of America and her allies, predominantly NATO versus the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. You have those big five that Natso referred to, China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, and violent extremist organizations that are in the national defense strategy. Just to give you an example of how much the big five can touch anywhere on the other side of the globe, I saw four out of five of those threats when I was in the job as Naval Forces Europe, Africa, and the NATO commander for the southern flank. The only opponent that we didn't have to deal with, thankfully, was North Korea. But missile defense in Europe is about Iran. Violent extremists are everywhere on the continent of Africa and in Europe. And of course, China and Russia are there too. You know, I saw this up close and personal in the Arctic and the Baltic region and the Eastern Mediterranean and the Black Sea. During Baltops in 2015 and 16, I happened to be there in a perfect time. I got to command that exercise twice. The Chinese showed up in the Baltic and they were in Kiel at the end of the exercise, not invited by us, but invited by their German hosts. And they actually came over to USS Mount Whitney when we did the hot wash-up reception. The following year, when Chris Grady relieved me as 6th Fleet Commander and thankfully will be our new Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Chris reported back that there was a Chinese-Russian live-fire exercise after Baltop 17, just because they could and demonstrate that force. So these big five are everywhere. The Chinese are all over Africa, and I won't go into detail on this, but I've written extensively about it. You know, we expect there to be 2.5 billion people on the continent of Africa by 2050. It'll be the largest population in one concentrated area in the world, dwarfing even China and India. And 50% of those people are under the age of 26. The Chinese realize that. And so they're involved in development. They're competing with us and our European partners. They're all over the 54 countries on the continent of Africa. And they use lawfare and debt warfare to get their way. They suck up all the natural resources and the protein in forms of fish, rare earth minerals, and oil and gas, and they leave kind of detritus behind. They also call in their debts. They have investors like we do, and my favorite example is Sri Lanka, which was $8 billion in debt. The Chinese forgave $3 billion of that debt in order to get total control for 99 years over the port of Hambantota. And it's probably going to turn bad for the United States when the gates to that port go closed. That's a principal area that we participate in the Pacific. They're up in the high north in the Arctic. I've written about this with my piece on the Transpolar Bridge and a strategy on how to deal with that. And I just see a unitary approach in the Western Pacific, albeit necessary because of Chinese aggression outside the first and second island chains, and most particularly recently in Taiwan, as being a bad strategy. We've got to spread that peanut butter, not evenly over the bread, but we can't be totally distracted by what's happening in the Pacific and take away our force structure in Europe, Africa, and the Middle East. We've got to keep a footprint there. We saw how badly this went in Afghanistan with boots on the ground. And I think a lot of people regret the fact that we were unable to keep a small footprint there and maintain control like we did for the last 5 years. I think the multipolar approach to a multipolar world is the right way to go. Yes, China's the pacing threat, but we've got to be able to deal with two fronts. As Natso said, if one of these areas kicks off, like the Straits of Taiwan, the other members of the Big Five will not hesitate to take advantage of our distraction and operate elsewhere. You're seeing that now. Straits of Taiwan, Xi Jinping pressurizing that country while Putin pressurizes the Ukraine and Poland through Belarus. So thanks for the opportunity to comment on that. Back to you, Jim.
Can I have a two-finger here on the point that Jamie just mentioned? And he talked about spreading the peanut butter evenly. That I think he's got it exactly right. We should be concerned if we do try to spread it evenly. And put it in the context of the mobility of naval forces. There's some discussion now about strategic error in sending the FDNF carrier to the Middle East. This is what naval power is about. We can move rapidly. I mean, Admiral Donegan, when he was Fifth Fleet, would talk about virtual presence as actual absence, not in the mind of those people that you're trying to deter. And Air Force is in the same way. They're not quite as mobile as naval forces. They do need a bed down footprint, but they can rapidly establish that. And they've got numerous bases around the world. The Army is a little more challenged, but they're recognizing this. They're becoming more mobile as well. So we just have to be more thoughtful about our strategic interest globally and not get too focused on the latest bright, shiny object, even as consequential as China is. The action may come out of Russia. And the last point I'll make here is if there is an issue that we have to deal with militarily with respect to Russia, you can bet others are going to take advantage of it. I talked about the non-state actors and violent extremists. There are primary actors, peer competitors, that are going to take advantage of that to move as well. Thanks.
Thanks, Havelfoot. Based on the discussion of Russia, you know, given where they've deployed the Russian forces around Eastern Europe, Ukraine, and the increased tension between NATO and our allied countries, what I want to try to provide for our listeners is an understanding of what President Putin is trying to accomplish. What is his government trying to do? Is he merely doing a demonstration? Is he putting forces there to force an end game that doesn't include conflict? Or, you know, is he really motivated to look at invasions of Ukraine or Belarus or Poland, whatever? What does success look like for him? You know, how does he get this to an end game without becoming open conflict? I'd like to have first your thoughts on that, Admiral Fogo, and then Admiral Swift.
Okay, thanks, Jim. You know, I'm passionate about this subject. I mean, we just talked about, you know, how some of these Big Five are ganging up on us. President Xi and President Putin are really testing the administration in light of our withdrawal from Afghanistan and the uncertainty that was raised within some of our partners and allies. And from my perspective and the people I talked to, many of the allies did not feel adequately consulted, nor were they satisfied with the logistics of the withdrawal. There's no argument at all that that war had to end. But the manner in which we executed the drawdown, the withdrawal, was less than satisfactory. And so at this particular time in history, I think that President Putin sees some cracks in the traditional solidarity of the alliance that he wants to exploit. And he picks his moments very carefully, in fact, and I give him a lot of credit for being a very capable adversary and strategist with his planners. And Russians love to plan. I've seen that up close and personal in my time in Europe. Yeah, one of Putin's biggest problems is a failing economy. We keep saying they're about to break, that gas prices have to remain above $40 a barrel. I mean, they're certainly up right now, so he's doing well. But he'd like to see that continue over the long term. And so the economy in Russia has its ups and downs. But we know the Russians can take a suffering and a lot of beatings. He won concessions from the Biden administration on this vis-a-vis the Nord Stream 2 pipeline when the president met with him after the NATO summit and said, you know, hands off, and Germany and Russia be able to allow the oil to flow. Interestingly, the Germans put a stop on that while they worked through some legal details and some last-minute questions. I don't think that that would have precluded the flow of that oil, but that's certainly an irritant to President Putin, and he probably suspects that there was some, you know, back scenes, nefarious activity there. He's very upset about any talk of a membership action plan for our two Partnership for Peace nations, Georgia and Ukraine. And let me explain. You can join the Partnership for Peace in NATO to help reform your military and show progress towards that reform in order to then get the next step, which is a membership action plan, a number of tailored things that a nation must do to become a NATO member. We have not offered, NATO has not offered a membership action plan to either Georgia or Ukraine for a number of reasons, both political and militarily, and it would be exacerbating the relationship with the Russians right now to do that. Putin wants a guarantee that we will never do that. That would be a mistake, an absolute mistake, and it would be a failing of partners and allies to support the principles that we believe in as a democratic nation and that NATO believes in through the Washington Treaty of 1949, which is the NATO charter. So Putin has put pressure on the West and on NATO and on the United States and on Ukraine by building up this massive force on the borders of Donbas. You know, we were talking the other day, it reminds me one of my favorite movies, and that was Empire of the Sun with Christian Bale, who's a very famous actor now. Many of your listeners know him when he was a child actor, and it was about the invasion of Hong Kong in December 1941. The kid's name is Jamie, like mine, and somebody gives him a paper airplane. He goes out and flies in a field near his father's estate. Father's a businessman. This airplane flies over a berm and disappears. And so Christian Bale and his birthday outfit runs up to the top of this berm, and there's about a battalion strength of Japanese soldiers staring back at him, waiting for the order to invade Hong Kong. That is the feeling that the Ukrainian people have right now as they wait for Putin's order to invade their sovereign democratic nation. It's like a sword of Damocles hanging over the head of President Zelensky and all the people there. And I know many of the Ukrainians, and they're very, very uncomfortable about this. What's Putin done to exacerbate even further? He's given away about 250,000 passports to Russian sympathetic Ukrainian citizens in Donetsk and Luhansk, which are two of the regions that are contested after the last illegal annexation of Crimea. He's pushing our buttons through Belarus and Poland to create kind of a two-front crisis in Europe. And that's actually caused everybody to be back on their heels with this migrant crisis of people coming across the border. And he's created significant distractions for the Biden administration, which is trying to do a lot of things right now in the Western Pacific with our own economy, with, you know, the infrastructure plan to the tune of, you know, $1 trillion, and to the Build Back Better plan, which we need desperately in this country for, you know, our own healthcare concerns and infrastructure concerns. So Putin is certainly getting a lot out of this. And I think as we move through the podcast here, we can talk some more specifics about what his goals and objectives are and what a win means for him versus a win for us. Back to you and Natsa.
Thanks, Admiral Fogo. Admiral Swift, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would just say that, just for a little bit of background to give you context of my actual the focus point to deliver here, and that is that Russia views China as a partner of consequence. China views Russia as a partner of convenience. I use the historical perspective of the relationship between Germany and Italy in the run-up and during World War II. China is analogous to Germany, and Russia is analogous to Italy. And it comes down to economics. You know, that's just as Jamie said, you know, Russia has a real challenge with their economy. There's an awful lot of discussion and dialogue about a sense of urgency within China based on concerns of its ability to maintain its growth rate, which is a significant requirement. I mean, they've got to maintain 7-8% growth rate to remain competitive and responsive to the expectations they've set within the Chinese people. So China's watching carefully what Russia is doing, and they're taking notes. I think their approach is largely economic coercion rather than military coercion. You know, Russia is adjacent to these areas that they're intimidating with their military forces. They're very smart how they use their special forces. You know, we've seen that. Jamie knows that from an Africa perspective and in Syria. But the economic coercion that China leverages, Jamie already mentioned it with the port of Hambantota in Sri Lanka. We've seen it in Gwadar in Pakistan, and we've seen it in Djibouti as well. the point to make here is that they are partners, but they have a different perspective between the two. But you can believe that China's watching very carefully the actions that Russia is taking and figuring out, is there a place in their playbook for similar activities? Thank you.
Thanks, Admiral Swift. So just to drill down into this a little bit further and bring this down to a DOD issue, there's a lot going on the diplomatic front, obviously. Do you see the possibility of this transitioning from diplomatic rhetoric into kinetic events, any kind of conflict? How do you see the diplomatic response evolving here over time? What deterrent posture with China do you have to maintain while you're focused in this Ukraine, Eastern Europe scenario, particularly with respect to almost to back to the last question, what does Putin want from this? What gets us or keeps us from going kinetic? And if we go kinetic, what are the triggers you think might lead down that path? Admiral Fogo, based on your European experience, I'd like you to take that first, please.
Hey, thanks, Jim. I think Putin definitely wants a summit and more than just a virtual summit. He was quoted in the newspaper today, from some of the rhetoric that's come out of the virtual summit last Tuesday with President Biden and President Putin as, hey, I really want to see you in person, so he wants that seat on the international stage to show that he is an important statesman as well. He wants a declaration of a stop to NATO expansion to the east, particularly the Ukraine and Georgia. I don't think we should give that, and I don't think we're going to give that. He wants a guarantee that they will not become members for perpetuity. And, that, again, is a violation of all the principles we stand for. I think he wants gas to flow on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. And he also wants to have the monopoly on oil and gas flowing into Eastern Europe. Putin, as I said, wants to be on the world stage. He's been on the world stage, although most people didn't notice when we've had two dust-ups. One, a fairly significant kinetic event with a lot of casualties in Nagorno-Karabakh last November between the Armenians and Azerbaijan, and Putin was the one that brokered the peace. He did it again about a couple of months ago when they were back at it, and that conflict is going to go on for a while, and he'll continue to engage. I think we have a role there too, but we haven't done that. I think he wants a Yalta-like agreement. Remember, for some of your listeners, Yalta took place in February 1945, and it was between Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill. Note the French were not invited, a la AUKUS. I think the French need to be involved today and should be involved in this, and they have been involved in the Normandy talks, which have tried to deal with the issues on the border, and I'll talk about that in a minute. At the time in 45, Stalin agreed to enter the war in the Pacific. We split Germany into four sectors, and Stalin gained total autonomy in Eastern Europe and became, in the eyes of the media, a world leader in his own right, even though he was a tyrant. So it's ironic that we find ourselves in a similar situation today. And, one of my favorite authors, Santayana, used to say, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. So we got to be very careful how we move forward. There's an agreement that tries to regulate the situation on the border in Donetsk and Luhansk. It's called the Minsk Agreement. It was really articulated by the Russians and the Ukrainians. It hasn't gone anywhere. It hasn't solved the problem. We're in a frozen conflict. A great international relations scholar, Angela Stent, wrote in a piece last week for Foreign Affairs, we need something like a Minsk follow-on agreement. The Normandy format that the French started hasn't worked either. But we've got to get the Russians and the Ukrainians and some adult supervision back to the negotiating table. It requires U.S. engagement and those of our allies and partners. If Putin can't get these things that I just talked about, the summit, the guarantee that Ukraine and Georgia won't join, the flow of oil and gas, what'll he do? Well, he's been doing it slowly. It's like the boa constrictor squeezing, around the throat of the Ukrainians. In some reports, up to 175,000 troops poised, to enter the country. That's not an exercise force. That's an invasion force. And at least this time in our history, we can say that we won't be surprised if he does it. We've been surprised in the past with Georgia in 2008 and Crimea in 2014. No surprises here. This is like the virtual buildup of our forces in Kuwait when we went back in the first Gulf War to take it back from Saddam Hussein. Everybody knew we were there and what we were going to do, but nobody knows exactly what Putin's going to do. After that virtual summit last week, he didn't withdraw. He dug in and he added more. He has consolidated his supply lines, and by some open source reporting, he's even working, taking a play out of our playbook and putting more medical facilities forward. you know, so he could probably do what we do with the golden hour. Why is he doing that? Well, I think he's doing that because he expects that if he does enter the country, he is going to suffer casualties, and so are the Ukrainians. I think that they will resist vehemently. This is not going to be the cakewalk for him that it was in Crimea, where he had a lot of sympathizers. Remember, they had a referendum, and you know, who knows if it was an honest referendum, but there were a lot of people that voted with the Russians there. But if he tries to go in, what he wants is some kind of a land bridge from Mother Russia down to the Black Sea. In order to do that, he's got to push in pretty far and then pull back. He may end up in the port of Mariupol. He may end up in Odessa. They've closed off the Sea of Azov to over 70% of civilian and military traffic. The Russians are in total control there. And if they go into someplace like Mariupol or Odessa or even closer to Kiev, there is going to be a lot of resistance. I've been in Odessa a couple times. I was there when the prime minister came down on USS Donald Cook for a visit. He just left the cabinet and the parliament up in Kyiv. You know, on the way down, somebody threw a hand grenade at the parliament and killed a police officer. When I asked him, well, was that a pro-Russian militia that did that? Absolutely not. It was a militia that was against autonomy for the regions of Donetsk and Luhansk, and a militia that was far right and wanted to fight the Russians. There's a lot of factions there that will be uncontrollable. So this could turn into a big civil war, and it could be bloody for both sides. And one of the last things I'll tell you is, when I worked for Admiral Mullen, we used to travel around the world to places like Iraq and Afghanistan, and he would opine all the time, privately and in public, you know, what about the mothers? He would say that. People would go, what's he talking about? Well, you know what? Everybody's got a mother. Every soldier has a mother. Every Russian soldier has a mother. Putin ran into this the last time in Ukraine and in Donbass when the body bags started to come home. There was, you know, there was unrest among the civilian population. They didn't like that. And for what cause and what purpose? He's got a problem with his poll numbers as a result of Alexei Navalny now sitting in the gulag in Siberia. And if he goes into Ukraine, he's going to suffer casualties. Maybe not as much as the Ukrainians, but can he deal with that? And will he be able to suppress it like he did last time? I think he's going to have to fess up that this will be a real bloody contest. So, you know, when you think about him entering and the Ukrainian reaction, again, I go back to Hollywood, but think about that movie Red Dawn. This one will be protracted for a long period of time and blood on both sides. I hope it doesn't happen, but as my old boss, Harry Harris, used to say, hope is not a plan. We'll see. Something will probably go down here at the end of January, beginning of February, when the ground freezes. Back to you, Jim.
Thanks very much, Admiral Swift. Anything you'd like to add on that discussion?
Yeah, but back to this discussion about the danger of a bipolar perspective, that it's, you know, our interests are tied, can be focused on one individual entity. You know, the challenge that I see here is with respect to potential of transitioning from diplomatic to kinetic. I think Jamie makes a great point that Russia may have fewer options than China has. That'd be an interesting focus for a broader debate. But I do think that specific to this question, I mentioned the dialogues that I have with Chinese counterparts. And one of the questions that was asked, you know, if there was an event, I mentioned this earlier, where might it occur? And I said it was a bit of a fool's errand to begin with, but a forced answer. I suggested that the most likely place for a trigger, location for a trigger of a conflict between U.S. and China would be the South China Sea, only because that area is so consequential in the minds of China. And with FOD ops and other activities, military forces are in close proximity to each other. I suggested that the most dangerous would be Taiwan, mainly because Taiwan issue is so central to the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party. And it goes to Jamie's point that it's difficult to tease out and understand exactly what the centers of gravity are that, if triggered, would reduce the options of de-escalation, even on the part of an aggrieved party that wanted to de-escalate. Which took me to my third point, is that I think this is true of Russia and Putin, but I defer to Jamie on that. But I believe it is true with respect to Xi and China, Biden. I think it was true of Trump and Obama as well. But just based on the discussions that are going on within the U.S. government, and based on the fact that the competition with China is truly economic, it's not military. It may play out in a military domain, and we're using military forces to participate in that competition and make statements. But with China and the U.S., it's truly an economic competition. But the primary parties on the Chinese side are the Chinese Communist Party and Xi Jinping. If you're challenging their legitimacy, then I think China is going to be a force to act. And because of the current situation in the United States within our own government, and the fact that the Chinese Communist Party and Xi Jinping have so much riding on the continued economic growth of China, I think we could rapidly get ourselves in a situation where neither side has the inability to de-escalate because of the opinions of our public, Chinese public on one side and the U.S. public on the other. The one place where there's unanimity in the U.S., and it certainly was highlighted in the NDA, is this overarching commitment that there's something that has to be done to counter China. I don't think it's sufficiently focused or well thought out. I think that competition is much more economic than it is military. And the first step forward and the second step forward, I think, should be diplomatic and not military. Those are concerns perhaps for another podcast. Let me close to bring it back to Jamie's domain. Let me highlight the deployment of Queen Elizabeth and her strike group. It had a U.S. DDG permanently assigned to it. It had a squadron of U.S. Marine Corps F-35s permanently assigned to it. It had a host of ships that attached and detached themselves from that strike group based on the national security concerns of the nation that it supported. Jamie can correct me on this. I think it was a UK ship and a Netherlands ship that from that strike group that steamed up into the Black Sea and conducted some exercises, making the statement, the diplomatic statement, that this area was of strategic consequences to those two nations that set those vessels up there. What enabled that is this overarching commitment of numerous nations, in particular the UK and the United States, to support this deployment, an inaugural deployment of Queen Elizabeth. It steamed through the Atlantic, through the Mediterranean, through the Indian Ocean, into the Pacific. It steamed in the South China Sea, the East China Sea. It operated with Japanese forces, Korean forces, Australian forces, Singapore forces, Indian forces. This is the application of military power in direct support of diplomacy. This is the way forward, I believe. But unfortunately, I think we're in such a crisis position with respect to Russia right now, it's difficult to think in that context. And I think Russia, you know, has us reacting, you know, tactically and operationally with an inability to really think deeply strategically about the long game. But again, that may be a subject for another podcast. But those are my initial thoughts.
Admiral Swift, thanks very much. So we've talked about sort of how we got here, where we are, what the likely future might be in terms of transitioning from diplomatic to potentially kinetic events. What I'd like to talk to now is to bring this back to our clients and how do they position themselves in ways that can assist the U.S. effort, both diplomatically and should it become necessary, kinetically. You know, what are the things they should be focused on to help prepare themselves to respond regardless of how this continues to develop? Admiral Swift, I'd like to start with you, please.
Well, the first thing I would say is that there's an awful lot that still holds true, certainly from a naval perspective, but I think it applies to the other services as well. And that is speed and range of weapons. I've been saying for the last, you know, 7 years that I'm platform agnostic. What I need is weapons that are platform agnostic, system agnostic. There's a lot of discussion about hypersonics, but I'll be frank with you. I'm a little concerned about hypersonics, that we may have a binary approach to hypersonics, that if we could just figure that out, we're going to be good. We have to maintain this broad perspective of what are the inventory of weapons that we need that are effective in countering today's threats. I mean, Admiral Aquilino beats this drum constantly, which is We need to focus on the threats that we face today. We're not in a position that we can just look into the future. And we talk about the valley of death, the acquisition system. That's real. So we need capability. We need to embrace innovation. It's difficult for DoD to do it because of the policies that we have in place. This is an area where a company like Sypris, and I'm thrilled to be associated with Sypris for this reason, others as well, but primary this one. How do we work with the defense industrial base to move more quickly, to move beyond this valley of death of acquisition and get meaningful capability into the warfighters at the tactical edge today? There's numerous examples I could cite. I won't go into it now, but that's an area to focus on. The other area that I would focus on is it's just not the kinetic side, and it's not just space. It's not just those domains. And it's not just cyber in the way that we've talked about cyber. So I haven't shared this publicly before. I've been talking about this privately quite a bit, but it goes to the Colonial Pipeline issue of the hackers attack. Very sophisticated hackers that shut down refined petroleum flow across the eastern half of the United States. You can bet that China and others have been looking at that closely. If we get into conflict with Taiwan, we have to assume that a cyber attack wouldn't come in the context of how we're thinking about it now, in my opinion. Think about the context. If you shut down 40%, 50% of the flow of refined petroleum products across the United States, where would the public be? That may be a binary approach. They may be all in, or they may be, why is Taiwan so consequential to the future and the national security of the United States? So this is where I think we need to team with industry. That's why podcasts like this are so important, that we get beyond the tactical leeches. Critically important to think strategically, develop a strategic vision, plan operationally, develop an operational framework, and then act tactically. And what I see so often is that people think, plan, and act tactically, and they don't understand why we can't get ahead of the competition. And this is an area where we need much deeper teaming between DoD and the industrial base. I see this in the service secretaries are talking a lot about this. I'll be honest with you, I'm a big believer, even though it's being criticized by many quarters, in Secretary Austin's integrated deterrence. I think integrated deterrence, a lot of that is working more closely and openly between DoD and the defense industry, and not just in the context of kinetics, not just in the context of cyber the way we think of it, but much more broadly from a vulnerability perspective of the U.S. and that broad cyber footprint that we have and is so vulnerable from an outward-facing perspective. I'll stop at that point, but there is huge opportunity here for industry to be a much more proactive supporter. The barrier is not industry. There's a sense of urgency on the industry side. The barriers are the policies that we've put in place over the last 50 years to try to manage that defense sector that I'm not sure are as relevant today as they were when they were first initiated. Thank you.
Thanks, Admiral Swift. Admiral Fogel?
Hey, thanks, Jim. Absolutely fantastic comments. Couldn't agree more with you. Let me talk to one of the things that Natso brought up, and that was, presence in the Black Sea and, the HMS Queen Elizabeth and her deployment around the world, absolutely fantastic, with our Marine aviators from the U.S. and the F-35B employed on board. In fact, I think we had more aircraft than they do as they plus up, and we do a right seat, left seat. But that incident in the Black Sea that Natso was talking about was the HMS Defender doing a freedom of navigation op in a transit lane that everybody should be able to operate in, and the Russians pushed back. They actually claimed they fired on the ship. What was interesting, and maybe more interesting than that, because it was debunked by reporters that were on board, is that a couple nights before, somebody, and I don't know if there's been, any kind of forensics on this, I would assume yes, but I'm not privy to it, somebody spoofed AIS to show a couple of ships that were in Port Odessa off the coast of Sevastopol in a threatening posture to Russian forces in that port. I believe it was a Dutch ship and the Defender. And it was the U.S. Navy who had a presence during Exercise Seabreeze in Odessa that debunked that, our public affairs and strategic communications branch. Let's just look at how dangerous that was. that reminded me of the Gulf of Tonkin incident. You know, we went out and we claimed that we'd been fired upon by Vietnamese patrol boats, and ultimately we ended up in a protracted war. So by spoofing, you know, whoever did it, and I think we know who, by spoofing Allied ships off the coast of Sevastopol, think what you do to the crews of Russian ships that are in Sevastopol. They're on alert and their hair trigger when they come out. So we're about an inch away from an event that turns into a mistake or miscalculation that could lead to something in terms of a regional crisis there. The other thing I want to talk about for industry is, and I got a few suggestions here for specifics and big picture strategic stuff. Let's go with the strategic first. You know, there was an interesting essay in Proceedings in December this month by the Honorable Bob Work, who I think very highly of. He was a great Undersecretary of the Navy and a great DepSecDef. But he talks about the Navy being slavishly devoted to forward presence. And I'm sorry, but I disagree. I think that the Navy has to be present forward, but we've got to do this in terms of presence with a purpose and not presence for presence sake. Because if we try to do presence for presence sake, according to the insatiable desires of our and RFFs, request for forces of our combatant commanders, we will continue to burn out our hardware, which is our ships, and our software, which is our most precious commodity, and that's our people. But let's think about presence in terms of the Black Sea. Over the last month, we've had USS Mount Whitney, USS Porter, and USS Arleigh Burke in there, two very capable Aegis-class destroyers with a view of the radar horizon that goes well into the air, over sea, and over land. And we're able to provide early warning for some of these things that are going on out there. And I dare say that if the Aegis presence remains and the Russians do something, the first person to see it is going to be, you know, the commanding officer on that ship reporting back. That's really important. You know, you can fly any kind of Air Force platform you want for ISR, but it's ephemeral. It's a mission that lasts 12, 18, 24 hours. Those ships that are present are there for the duration as long as the Montreux Treaty allows them, and then they can be replaced with another ship when they come in. That's my pitch on presence, a la all the debate in the blogosphere and in Proceedings. And, you know, God bless for Proceedings for doing this. We dare to write about things that are controversial, and then you get a number of voices coming in. So for industry, on that note on presence, supporting readiness and modernization, the forward deployment of our ships and FDNF is very important. So if any of our clients are involved there, you know, keep it coming. I mean, I won't go as far as President Biden when he said that the backlog in LA could be fixed by overtime, but we could sure use some additional docks, some additional help, and some additional manpower, whatever they can do to help us out. Now, on the tactical, on the specifics, here's a couple things to remember. Remember, Bulgaria is a member of NATO, and they've purchased excess defense articles. They're buying the F-16 now, and they're buying other stuff. Romania is on the pointy end of the spear, probably one of our most capable allies there with a very capable Navy, trying to build corvettes, and they need defensive capabilities to protect their own shoreline as well. Georgia and Ukraine, I think whatever flows into Ukraine will be determined, you know, by the White House themselves as they navigate this very thorny period of time with Vladimir Putin, because everything sends a signal. Don't forget Turkey, a NATO member, an ally, and a key interlocutor. I say turnkey access for the Black Sea, because they basically administer the Montreux Convention, the Montreux Agreement, and safe passage through the Straits. So regardless of the political situation there between President Erdogan and a couple of administrations here, very important to keep the Turks close. And then there's Moldova, non-aligned and certainly penetrated by Russian strategic communications and other incursions, and we've got to be able to help them too. You know, clients and U.S. companies, if we ask ourselves, how can we provide support? To date, this is what the U.S. has provided to Ukraine. We sent two island-class Coast Guard cutters up there. My chief of staff commissioned them when I was back in Europe, and they're using them, and they're at sea. A couple more coming. About a half a dozen Mark 6 patrol craft have been issued to the Ukrainians, and lethal aid in the form of anti-tank weapons, Javelin weapons system. And that's going to cause damage if the Russian armor comes across that border. And that's why I said Putin knows that and he's preparing for that. You know, for the rest of the Black Sea and potential interest for our clients, you know, I hearken back to Andy Marshall's anti-Navy study, which became the famous acronym A2AD, Anti-Axis Area Denial. That's what those people need up there, our allies and partners. So there's a list. I mean, anti-ship cruise missiles, coastal defense radars, and the networks that link our allies and partners together. You know, the Bulgarians, the Romanians, the Georgians, and the Ukrainians all should have the same common operating picture on the threat and early warning. In order to defend themselves, you kind of got to build up the bastion of A2AD, and it's asymmetric, so it's cheaper. And a lot of our clients produce this kind of stuff. Smart mines, UUVs. Somebody said to me the other day, what about submarines? Well, what about submarines? The Russians have 6, 4 in the Black Sea, 2 in the Med. It's astonishing to me that as the commander of Allied submarine forces south, that in 2012, I was doing undersea rescue missions, bouncing off the top of a Russian Kilo-class submarine on the bottom off the coast of Cartagena. And here we are at odds with one another, you know, potentially kinetic odds with one another today. But you get the picture. We've got to help our allies with defensive capabilities in order to maintain the sovereignty of their own borders if they're NATO members, because it's a totally different picture if Putin goes into a NATO country. And that's where the president has said, President Biden, hey, if there's a violation of Article 5, we're all in. One for all for one. Ukraine is not a member of NATO, so it's a different kind of political environment. But nevertheless, I think the government has shown solidarity and support for the government of Ukraine, although he doesn't want to put boots on the ground. I get it. We had boots on the ground in Georgia in 2008. When the Russians came in and were throwing short-range and intermediate-range ballistic missiles, they were all around that compound. So I'm not sure that would necessarily do anything to alleviate the crisis. It might even exacerbate it more, and I'm sure that's what our politicians are thinking of if you were to take a battalion of the 82nd Airborne and put them outside of Kyiv. So probably smart ball not to go there and to try to work through this with President Putin and not give in to all his demands, but come up with some kind of compromise. Time will tell. Like I said, I think the end of January, beginning of February is going to be critical in this campaign. And thanks to you and Natso for including me today and having the opportunity to comment on what is a critical issue for the United States and her allies in the 21st century. Jim, back to you.
Gentlemen, thanks very much for your commentary. As always, insightful, and I'm sure it'll be useful to our clients. As we've discussed, this is a, you know, kind of a tenuous time in relations, both in Europe and Middle East and Asia. So, you know, the challenges are plentiful. I'd like to give you each an opportunity to close this out with any final comments you might have. And before I do that, I want to again say thanks for your time. I appreciate the insights. Admiral Swift, let's start with you.
Yeah, so as I'm listening to this discussion, I go back to my opening comments that I get so much of it myself. I just hope those that clients and others that listen to this feel the same way at the end. It takes an investment of time to pull these off, Jim. So I appreciate, you know, here we are in December, the amount of time that you put into making this podcast real. To the specifics of, as I think back and summarize this discussion, I'm reminded of the times that industry would come see me when I was the Pacific Fleet Commander, and they'd have a widget of some kind that they wanted me to advocate for. And they would say that this is going to rock your world. And I would set the widget down or the brief down, and I'd say, hey, tell me about my world. And the conversation would end. And that's not a knock on industry. That's a knock on the military. We've got these policy barriers that prevent us from talking openly the way we are now, to fully understand the environment. That's the first step, as Jamie pointed out. And I think this is one of the values that Cyprus brings, is that understanding of the environment. You know, that strategic discussion that we have once a month with all the Cyprus advisors is stunning, from all the services, you know, to understand the challenges of the world and translate that into, okay, what can the Cyprus clients do to support? So I hope the takeaway from this is not a one and done conversation. It's, as we said, it's not binary. It's not just about China. It's not just about Russia. It's not just about the two of them. This is a dialogue that needs to consider. And I think Cyprus is a great venue by which to have that conversation, develop that deeper understanding, and then figuring out what products and what concepts have value. Instead of chasing technology for technology's sake, what are the things that we have within our inventory of stuff, talking about a Cypress client, and how can we apply them to the problem set today? You know, I think that's the nexus of the value that Cypress brings to a client. So again, as Jamie pointed out, thrilled to be able to participate in this. Thrilled for an invitation. You know, I'll be frank, Jim, for another podcast in the future. I get an awful lot out of this, and I hope the clients feel the same way. Thank you very much.
That's all. Thanks. You and your family have a great Christmas. Jamie, over to you.
Hey, thanks, Jim. Just some brief remarks here as we wrap up and get ready for the holidays. I think the discussion today has been very stimulating, hopefully helpful to everybody listening in. I've really enjoyed working with you and NASA on this specific problem set of the Ukraine and other associated areas of the world, whether it's Sea of O, Sea of Japan, Straits of Taiwan, Yellow Sea, that NASA had to deal with as a four-star commander out in the Pacific. But I think the lesson that I take away from this, and I hope that your clients do too, is that it's going to be really important to be involved in the maritime domain. One of my favorite authors, Robert Kaplan, wrote in Asia's Cauldron, and I've oft quoted him, that this is not just the naval decade, it's the naval century. We are challenged by the stopping power of water, which is why we build these magnificent ships, some of them having nuclear propulsion that can get us across, you know, vast areas of water quickly and remain there, you know, with agility, flexibility, and dwell for a long period of time. And that gets to the issue of forward presence. Like I said earlier, we need presence with a purpose, not presence for presence's sake. And the support that industry and our shipbuilders and those who make our weapon systems and our sensors can bring to the table for the United States Navy is really, really important. Despite the debates and despite the critiques of some particular platforms, you know, portions of the Navy strategy on how we operate, we're going to have to continue to operate there for a long time. It may be a little cliche-esque, but I go back to probably every American president who, in the midst of a crisis, wakes up in the morning. And, you know, this Ukraine thing could turn into President Biden and President Putin's Cuban Missile Crisis as this thing heats up over the holidays. But when the president wakes up in the morning, you know, you've heard it before, he'll ask, where are my carriers? They're forward deployed. They're ready to go. 90,000 tons of sovereign U.S. territory and firepower and diplomacy. And because they're forward deployed, they give the National Command Authority decision space and options, which you don't get from, you know, other types of platforms that may or may not be out there, that may be here in the United States. So the Navy is doing very important work, and support for the Navy is extremely important. And it's much tougher for our naval leadership now than it ever has been in the past. The Cold War and the Third Battle of the Atlantic was pretty rough. I spent a lot of time at sea as a JO, not as much as my COs, who never saw the light of day. But that was a bipolar world. We're in a multipolar world right now. We talked about all those big five, you know, not so articulated, the threats out in the Pacific. Very, very tough to try to be able to do this with the limited resources that we have. And so God bless all of our sailors and our Marines that are out there on the pointy end of the spear. You know, those who won't be able to celebrate the holidays with their families. And thank goodness that those young men and women are sailing our ships and flying our aircraft and our amphibious vehicles and doing it for us and our partners and allies. So thanks, Jim, for the opportunity to participate. It's been absolutely fantastic, and I wish everybody a great holiday period. And we'll see what happens after Christmas, and whether or not this thing goes away or whether it turns into a protracted conflict. I hope the former and not the latter. Thank you.